guy that came in number one in the runoff, Macron or Macroni or whatever his name is. Do you know that his wife is 25 years older than he is? He met her. He was a student at age 15, and some teacher of his, they got married. She's 25 years older. She's 64. He's 39 or something like that. He'd be the youngest president, prime minister, premier, whatever they call him, dictator of France. I'm just joking about dictator.
Rush Limbaugh yesterday talking about the presidential election in France. iHeartRadio syndicates his show, but iHeartRadio has $20 billion worth of debt. We'll find out what it's doing to avoid bankruptcy. First, though, 3 years ago today, the city of Flint, Michigan switched its water supply from Lake Huron to the Flint River, and that caused lead poisoning in thousands of children. Residents today are still drinking bottled water. More than 40% of Flint's residents live in poverty, and that is very different from San Marino. The small city just south of Pasadena is home to the Huntington Museum and million-dollar mansions. But according to a new investigation into LA County's lead levels, San Marino has a higher rate of lead poisoning in children than Flint, Michigan. 17% of the children in San Marino have excessive levels of lead in their blood. Compare that to just 5% of Flint's children. We're going to speak with one of the reporters of that investigation, Michael Pell of Reuters, and the mayor of San Marino, Richard Sun. Let's begin with the mayor. Mayor Sun, welcome to the program.
Thank you for letting me talk at your program.
Well, thanks for being here. What's your reaction to this news?
Well, actually, I was interviewed by Reuters reporter, Joshua, about 2 weeks ago, and I was very, very surprised, just like any other Seminole residents, to know that in our community, which I've been living here for 40 years, has actually one of the census district has the highest blood lead level in the county here.
Yeah, so you were very surprised.
Right.
So what do you think you're going to do now in response?
Actually, after the interview with Joshua, we already taken some actions already. Action we were taking is that we want to retrieve the data directly from the county, because the data shown to me is from Joshua, the Reuters reporter's computer. So it's not a formal document. It's some research he was doing. Mm-hmm. So we are right now trying to retrieve the data directly from the county. And we would like to talk to the county doctor. Actually, the doctor has already made arrangement to meet with us tomorrow. We want to find out how the sample were, how the sample were collected. In other words, we would like to know, for instance, the children. For instance, if the children were local from here, or the children, from somewhere else, like immigrants. Okay, because what I found out is from the data. It's not just San Marino. It's actually all the neighboring cities, city of Rosemead, Arcadia, Monrovia, South Pasadena, all the San Gabriel, all those neighboring communities here all have much higher BLL. It's more than San Marino.
Lead levels.
Right.
So are you worried or wondering why, if the county has this information or has had this information, it didn't share it with you already?
That's one question we need to find out with the county.
Okay.
Because obviously the county has the information, but it was never passed down to us until the reporter. I really appreciate Joshua for what he did to let us know. Now, what as a city we have been doing also, we request our water utility company KLM to do the water check the lead level in the water. So they responded already, and they will do that right away sometime in May.
All right.
Another thing we did is that we are going to strengthen the ordinance, which we draft already, and which shall be discussed on Friday at the council meeting. In other words, for any kind of renovation, remodeling, or demolition, as long as it's involved lead, involved with paint, okay, we want to get AQMD clearance first before the house can be for the renovation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us and sharing your concerns, and we'll be following your story. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right, very good. Thank you for interviewing.
My pleasure. That's Mayor Richard Sun of San Marino. Let's talk now with Michael Pell, Joshua's co-reporter on this story, and talk a little bit more about what you discovered in San Marino.
Well, what we found was a sad story of a child just a little west of San Marino who was living in a house with chipping, flaking paint on the floor. The house was actually owned by Caltrans. And Caltrans sent some contractors in to perform some work on a bathroom, and the contractor showed up in hazmat suits. The family was understandably concerned, said, hey, should we be here while you're doing this work? We don't have hazmat suits on. And they were told, don't worry about it. This is fine. We're just going to perform our work. They did, and little Connor kept on crawling around on the ground. And shortly thereafter, he had his first blood lead level test, and it was a high level.
Hmm.
To this day, he still has occupational therapy. He needs therapy classes. And in 2015, 3 years after the family moved into the house, they settled a $10 million case with Caltrans.
Wow. So this was in South Pasadena, I believe.
Right.
In some of those homes that were owned by Caltrans. So, and yep. In San Marino, also there are old houses, some of which have this lead-based paint, I suppose, that are being renovated. What else could possibly be causing the lead poisoning at such high levels?
So San Marino does have older homes. San Marino also has, it's not clear exactly what from the data what is causing the elevated lead levels. The older homes is a kind of something that people will look at right away to determine if that's possibly what it is. The renovation work on the homes, people, like the mayor said, perhaps renovators aren't doing the work properly.
Mm-hmm.
It could also be, though, food that's being brought in from overseas. It could be pottery that's been being brought in from Mexico. There are a lot of sources of lead, and that's why experts tell us it's so important to test kids, because you don't know where the lead exposure is coming from, and it's difficult to predict which kids are going to have elevated lead levels, even though often it is poverty-stricken areas and areas with older homes. I think that what you can see from our map is that that you can't just stick to the areas where you assume kids have lead poisoning.
So San Marino and some of the other communities nearby have a large Chinese immigrant population. Are you suspecting that some of the food that they're importing from China may have lead in it?
That's a concern. I mean, we've seen that tainted products have come from China in the past, and it's something that regulators are sometimes on the lookout for. Not just China, though. Mexico as well, mm-hmm. South Asia. We talked with some health experts in Buffalo who told us that they work with a lot of South Asian communities in Buffalo, and they warned against eating certain curry powders. And so the same
wow.
could be true in Los Angeles as well.
So it's not just the water, like in Flint.
No, it's not just. And in Flint, it wasn't just the water mm-hmm. either. The water did cause there was a serious problem with the water and a serious betrayal of trust involving the water system. And there was a spike in the number of kids with elevated lead levels when they switched that water system. But there was also exposure in Flint due to lead-based paint as well. And so it could be a water issue in San Marino. In homes that you find lead paint, often you find lead plumbing as well. Older homes have lead paint. Older homes have lead plumbing.
And sometimes when they do the test, they do it at the source, right? And they don't do it where you actually get the water, which is from your tap. And along the way, the water could be contaminated from maybe some lead pipe fittings.
According to the lead and copper rule, the EPA requires water authorities to conduct testing at the tap. Now, there are a lot of problems with the rules that allow utilities to kind of game the system, but they should be testing that water at the tap. But you're right that the contamination usually happens someplace between the water source and the tap. That could be the service lines. It could be solder in the pipes in your home. It could be a lot of different things.
Where else in LA County did you see elevated levels?
Sure. The West Adams neighborhood, mm-hmm. South of downtown, There was a Josh was out there and talked to a family about a sad story that they had. Downtown area had a tremendous number of zip codes clustered there with a high percentage of tested kids with elevated lead levels. I mean, if you look at the map that we put together, you can see that there are clusters scattered throughout LA County.
Michael Pell is a data journalist for Reuters, and you can see that map on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Michael, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Well, if you've been to Silver Lake in the last few years, you've probably seen the large, empty concrete hole that was the Silver Lake Reservoir. Well, all that changes today. Record snowpack levels in the Sierra are starting to melt, so the LADWP is turning on the valves to start refilling the reservoir ahead of schedule. Not everyone is celebrating. Joining us now to discuss that is Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor for Curbed. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with why this reservoir was drained in the first place. It's been empty for the last 2 years. Why was it drained?
So a few years ago, over 10 years ago, there were new federal laws that changed the way that water could be stored in urban areas. So the reservoir was used as a drinking water kind of emergency source if we needed it. And now federal rules require that to be covered. So they relocated the water source to an area of Griffith Park, and a pipe was installed to kind of bypass the reservoir and connect the city's water system below it.
So when it's refilled, it's not going to be drinkable water. It's just for looks?
It's just for looks, exactly.
Okay, and maybe some firefighting possibilities?
That's true. I mean, yes, we have used the reservoir in the past for, you know, there was a fire in Griffith Park a few years ago. There's been other reasons that we've needed it. And yeah, and what we should mention also that, you know, there's a lot of wildlife that live in the reservoir, mm-hmm. and it's ducks that swim around in there. So they are taking advantage of the new water as well.
Well, there has been a lot of discussion about what could be done with this, and it was seen by some as an opportunity to just redesign the whole thing, make it a park, make it accessible to all. The landscape architect, Mia Lehrer, had an ambitious plan for the reservoir. What's happening with all that?
Well, this plan actually predates the most recent draining of the bathtub, or whatever you want to call it. I call it a brutalist bird bath. But
so a lovely turn of phrase.
So the plan was actually, you know, in place long before this last time we've drained it. It's been drained a few times in recent years for different reasons, and every time I think there's a good opportunity to have a discussion about, you know, what should happen with this body of water if it no longer needs to serve this purpose for the city. So one of the plans that Mia Lehrer came up with, and Mia's a great landscape architect who's done plans for the LA River, many parks around LA, was to open it up and create access. So, you know, re-sculpt the wetlands that these birds and other animals use in a way that would serve them in a better way, and also serve the neighbors and other people who live around the lake with a great public space that would allow people to maybe use the lake with boats or other kind of recreational devices, as we've seen in lakes like Echo Park, or just allow people to walk around it in a way that's not blocked by a fence, which has been up there for quite some time.
So is that plan now dead, now that they're refilling the reservoir?
I wouldn't say it's dead, but it will have to be revisited, because I think part of the plan was that while the lake was drained, and I keep calling it a lake because it's no longer a reservoir. We can call it something different now, I guess, since it's not
Silver Lake Lake, maybe?
Silver Lake Lake, yeah. but yeah, I think the idea was that while it was drained, would be a remarkable opportunity for the city to take, you know, what was a construction site and re-sculpt the bottom of the lake, because what it happens now is it just becomes like a bird bath or a bathtub. We just fill it back up with water. That water is not going back into the water table. It can't be used to mitigate stormwater issues. So we have a lot of concerns, people who, you know, care about how we deal with water, about the fact that we're just using snowmelt to just fill up a little basin again that's not going to really serve a purpose.
Yeah. And so the next time there's a drought, what then?
Exactly. Like, just the fact that we have this great, you know, Sierra blessing coming our way, doesn't mean that this will be the case next year or the year after that. And the lake loses a great deal of water due to evaporation every summer. So we're going to have to be refilling it if we want it to stay to those gorgeous levels that make it look really good.
But you could fill it in with something that's not water and then just put a little bit of water on top, like 5 feet, right?
Right. Yeah. And that was part of Mia's plan, was to make it a lot shallower. It doesn't need to be that deep. It doesn't need to be that deep for the birds that live there. It doesn't need to be that deep for any other reason except to store a ton of water in the middle of the city. So exactly, if we could make it shallower, naturalize the banks, make it, you know, a couple feet instead of very, very deep bathtub, that would probably be better for both conserving water and for serving the people who use it.
So you're saying the plans aren't dead, but it does make it more difficult when there's already water in it.
It does, yeah. I mean, naturalizing the shoreline is something that a lot of people have agreed upon, even people who disagree with what should happen. It's a, just, you know, a bunch of asphalt kind of paved around the edge of this water, big body of water. So that would probably be harder to do with water in it if they wanted to naturalize it. I think planting it with some things could work, but it wouldn't be the same as, you know, naturalizing the entire basin.
So who is against this?
I think there's against refilling it or against
against turning it into a big park.
So I think there's concerns in the neighborhood that making it into a destination would create problems with more people coming to the neighborhood and creating traffic. I think traffic's a big concern for a lot of people that live there. The Meadow, for example, which is a park that's on one side of the reservoir but outside of the gate, it's just a very simple green space that was created a few years ago. And even that was a very contentious issue within the neighborhood, because the idea is that if, you know, more people want to come to this place, more people will be driving or, you know, taking up space, parking spaces in the neighborhood.
So it was basically the homeowners who didn't want more people in the neighborhood.
I mean, I think that there's also a lot of concerns about, yes, there are a lot of neighbors who agree with that, but there's also some conservation questions. There's mm-hmm. people who are worried about the wildlife being disturbed. There's herons that live in the eucalyptus trees on a grove on the western side. There's coyotes that live in there. So there's a lot of other questions about how this nature is coexisting with humans in the middle of the city. So there are those issues as well.
Right. But as you say, it was done nearby at Echo Park Lake.
That's true. Echo Park Lake was a really interesting situation. It was actually paid for with some stormwater funds that we voted for a long time ago, Prop O, 2004, I believe. So that's actually a project that is in partnership with the Bureau of Sanitation. And it's this great example of what I was speaking about before, how we can naturalize the surface of the lake. We can bring more waterfowl and different animals to come visit, and they get a better environment. And then people can actually use the lake with the animals in a way that, you know, changes the relationship to water in the area and, you know, traps the water that's coming down from the hillsides and, you know, lets it sink back into the water table.
Well, in general, though, isn't Los Angeles park poor given how many residents live here?
Absolutely. We are kind of one of the worst big cities when it comes to parkland per capita.
And so is there any discussion now of increasing these parks, or at least reimagining some spaces that are fallow, like, I don't know, old parking lots or things like that, and turning them into green spaces?
Absolutely. And the other big issue is, you know, these reservoirs are found all over the city. There is places that drinking water or emergency drinking water, or, you know, any kind of agricultural water has been stored traditionally all over the city. So other places are going to have to kind of confront this issue of what do we do if this water isn't serving this purpose? There's examples of reservoirs that have been filled in completely and covered, you know, over with dirt and planted with grass and to turn into playing fields. Bellevue Park, which is not too far away from the Silver Lake Reservoir, is a good example of that. And then with the LA River, we also have this big question of how do we all live together and cooperate with nature and create these spaces that serve both our animals and our humans, but in a way that, you know, helps us make up that huge disparity when it comes to parkland in this city.
Alyssa Walker is the urbanism editor at Curbed. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And we want to hear from you. What would you like to see happen to the Silver Lake Reservoir or to our park system in general? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, iHeartMedia bought Clear Channel a while ago. It owns hundreds of radio stations that air stars such as Rush Limbaugh, Ryan Seacrest. Well, now iHeartMedia may have to file for bankruptcy. That's next on Press Play.
Yeah. Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Turn on the radio and go further up the dial, and you'll hear the hits on KISS FM or Real 92.3. Those stations, plus the popular AM talk radio station KFI, are all owned by iHeartMedia. iHeartMedia bought Clear Channel, which means it now owns more than 800 radio stations across the country, and it airs big stars like Rush Limbaugh and Ryan Seacrest. It's also in trouble, big trouble. It has $20 billion worth of debt. For more on how that happened and what it means for what you hear on the radio, we're joined now by Gene Mattis, senior media writer for Variety. Hi, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, how much of iHeartMedia's financial problems, how much of them are due to basically a loss of listeners who aren't listening to their shows anymore?
Not that much. I think it's basically, it took on a lot of debt back when it was Clear Channel that the company in 1995 or six, there was a deregulation that allowed companies to sort of get big, and they took on a lot of debt buying up all these radio stations. They had more than 1,000 radio stations at one point. And then the company sold in a leveraged buyout in 2008, which was sort of the absolute tippy top of the market. Mm-hmm. It's just never been worth what it sold for since then. So most of it is just sort of the debt that they took on in the leverage buyout, and a little bit from preceding that when they were buying up all these stations. It's more about the balance sheet really than
right.
than the health of the company as a radio company.
So why though hasn't it been able to make that balance sheet look better? I mean, it's been nearly 10 years.
Well, the radio business. I mean, a lot of the advertising has gone. Advertising dollars have gone to places like Google and Facebook and away from radio. So, you know, the company is just not, you know, going to be as big as maybe people thought in 2008. So that's, you know, that's a lot of it. And they have sort of tried mightily to sort of refashion themselves as kind of a digital 21st century company. You sort of think of a radio company as sort of having this kind of musty kind of 1970s feel to it, and they sort of worked very hard to change that brand, that image, to sort of say, hey, we're digital, we're tech, we have an app, and you should listen on your smartphone and that kind of stuff. And I think there was a feeling maybe earlier on that they could, you know, perform some kind of miracle and sort of achieve a sort of tech company kind of valuation, and that just hasn't happened.
Mm. So do people use that iHeartRadio app?
Some people do. A lot more people use Pandora and Spotify, which are the sort of leaders in the audio streaming world. But iHeart is number three behind those two. But the question is more to do with, does that actually make money? And Pandora and Spotify, of course, both lose money. So it doesn't add much to the bottom line to have, you know, an app that doesn't really make any money. It might have, you know, several hundred thousand listeners or something, but if it doesn't really add to the bottom line, it's not going to help you with your debt problem.
Yeah. Well, so what are they going to do to deal with that debt problem? Something's got to give.
So it's been clear, I think, for a while that, you know, some sort of restructuring is going to happen here, and by that I think we mean bankruptcy, basically. They have been engaging in some very clever stuff, moving assets around and suing their debt holders and so on to sort of stave this off. And then most recently they made an exchange offer about a month ago telling the debt holders, you know, will you take, a little bit less, with a later maturity date and a lower interest rate, as a way of sort of preventing us from having to declare bankruptcy, and then, you know, you might lose everything in that mm-hmm. scenario. And so far that the debt holders have refused to take that deal. So if the debt holders ultimately do not, agree to exchange their debt for, you know, and buy them more time, basically. You know, they could be declaring bankruptcy. I think they've said, you know, within a year.
Would they? Wow. Would they sell radio stations?
You know, what would probably, so we'd all go into bankruptcy court, and you know, there would be some sort of swap of debt for equity, and so you'd probably see the debt holders ending up owning the company. The question, you know, would it benefit anybody to start breaking up the radio conglomerate and start selling off radio stations piece by piece? And it's not clear that it would really help the ultimate owner of this company to sort of split it up that way. It's probably more valuable ultimately as, you know, this behemoth that we all know that, you know, can sell to national advertisers, and national advertisers know, like, if they want national radio play, they go to iHeart. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make a ton of sense. Whoever owns it, I mean, it's really a question of who's going to end up owning this at the end of the day. You know, whoever owns it is going to want to have that national footprint.
Right. Well, speaking of national footprints, how are the big stars like Rush Limbaugh and Ryan Seacrest, how are they doing? Are they still immensely popular?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of recall that Rush Limbaugh had some issues with some advertisers a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the idea of radio as being sort of central to the culture, you know, in the way that it was 10, 20, 30 more years ago, that's kind of faded away with, you know, streaming and podcasting and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and to iHeart's credit, they do streaming and podcasting. But, you know, there's a general sense that radio isn't the business that it may once have been, and that, you know, it'll just be smaller. And so I think Rush Limbaugh's contract, for instance, I mean, they don't make it public, but it's been reported that it's, you know, for less money than his previous contract. And that's sort of a sign of the way things are going. But if you say that to radio people, they will sort of get very
defensive, like I'm feeling right now.
Very, the radio people are great because they really love their business, and they will tell you that it is extremely healthy and it's a profit-making business. And if you just wiped away all this debt that iHeart and Cumulus is the other company that has a lot of debt, you know, you'd see that radio, in fact, is a healthy, strong business. And you know, they have a point.
You have a point. There's a lot of traffic here in LA, so that's good for radio. At least,
yeah,
that's good for us.
I mean, it's not what it was, but that doesn't mean, I mean, like newspapers, you know, newspapers mm-hmm. are still there. And you know, we went through the same thing with Tribune Company declared bankruptcy. It's not like the LA Times went away. You know, there's still an LA Times. You know, it's just doesn't have the sort of dominance that it used to have. But that doesn't mean, you know, people aren't still there and they can't turn a profit.
Well, Gene, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Gene Mattis. He is senior media writer for Variety. Coming up, a woman who suffers from constant pain is giving researchers a new way to understand chronic pain and how to treat it.
Whether we'll totally eradicate pain, I don't know. But certainly my sense is that in the future, pain will be much, much more treatable.
The end of pain? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Stephen Peet has never felt pain, not when he broke more than 70 bones in his body, and not when he almost bit off his tongue when he was a baby. Pam Costa feels pain constantly. She has to wear loose clothing because even fabric hurts. She has a rare condition that makes her skin feel like it's always on fire. Stephen and Pam live just a few hundred miles away from each other in Washington State, and they both are helping scientists to identify a cure for pain without using opiates. Here to tell us more is Erica Hayasaki, author and contributor to Wired magazine, and she wrote recently about these two. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with Stephen Peet. What is his condition?
Stephen Peet has a condition called congenital insensitivity to pain, which is a rare condition in which he cannot actually feel pain. If you burn him, if you break his bones, nothing hurts him.
but it's actually not a good thing?
Right. It's tricky because you would think that we would all want to live in a world where we don't feel pain. But in fact, that's been quite hard on him. His body is broken down from all of the injuries. So it's dangerous because pain protects us. You know, his wife is constantly worried about him if he has a heart attack and won't feel it, or if he injures himself when he's working with tools, he might not realize how bad the problem is.
How many people have this condition? Because you would think evolutionarily that would be weeded out.
Right. It's rare, but there have been cases around the world, actually. There was one of the first cases was a Pakistani boy. He kind of became famous because he would walk on hot coals, and he actually died jumping off of a building. So he would do these stunts because he couldn't feel pain, and it injured him so badly that he did not survive. And like Stephen Pete as well, he would jump from buildings, jump from trees with his brothers, and, you know, injure himself, but not really understand the magnitude of what he was doing to his body.
Okay, and Pam Costa, she lives in Washington State as well, and she has the opposite condition. What is her condition called?
Right, her condition is called erythromelalgia, which is also known as man-on-fire syndrome, and so she feels pain all the time. If you look at her feet and her legs, they have this sort of purplish hue to them, and that's the blood vessels beneath her skin, which always feel like they're on fire. And the slightest irritation, like warm weather or clothes against her skin, can really set this off, put her in even a worse pain. So her life is also very difficult. She has to have air conditioners in her home all over the place, and fans and cooling pillows, and it's difficult for her to travel and to work.
And she must also be on a lot of medication.
Yes. She takes Aleve every day. She takes morphine, actually, every day to try to dull her pain. But none of it really works.
Erika Hayasaki, she's an author and contributor to Wired, where you can read her cover story. It's called The End of Pain. Erika, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to explain more about the science behind all this, let's bring in Dr. Stephen Waxman. He's a professor of neurology at the Yale Medical School and director of the Neuroscience Research Center at Veterans Affairs, Connecticut. Welcome.
Good to speak with you, Madeline.
Okay. Can you explain this gene? Is it basically that Stephen's is turned way low or off and Pam's is turned way too high?
That's exactly right. This gene encodes a molecule called a sodium channel. Sodium channels are the molecules that enable nerve cells to generate tiny nerve impulses, and that's how they talk to each other. That's how we have the world's most complex computer within our brains. Stephen and Pam have mutations in the gene that produces a sodium channel called NAV1.7. And that sodium channel is a master gene for controlling pain signaling.
Interesting. And does it work the same way with acute and chronic pain?
We believe that it does. We believe that it's involved as a regulator both of acute pain signaling and of chronic pain.
And so the signaling is basically the hurt happens and that signaling goes to the brain. And it does it through the sodium channel.
So that's how acute pain signaling occurs. You burn your finger or you touch a sharp object, and immediately there are pain signaling nerve cells that innervate the finger. They generate nerve impulses which travel to the spinal cord and then to the brain. That's how acute pain works. And acute pain, we call it nociceptive pain, is important. It serves a protective role because we immediately withdraw our limb or do something else that's protective.
Mm-hmm.
But there are forms of chronic pain where the pain signaling nerve cells take on a life of their own and generate nerve impulses when they shouldn't. And that produces something called neuropathic pain.
But it is still conducted through the same channel.
Yes, the same channel is involved, and not only involved, it plays a key role.
Okay, so you're researching Pam and her family, right?
We are. We're researching Pam and her family, and a number of other families around the world who have mutations in the gene encoding NAV1.7.
And what have you discovered in their family trees?
Well, what we've discovered is that in people with overactive NAV1.7 sodium channels, these individuals experience excruciating pain. And so they go through life experiencing pain when they shouldn't. We're learning from other families that when the gene for this channel causes the channel to be underactive or not to be produced, those individuals don't feel pain at all. And it's unusual in biology to have something that is so clear from both, from both sides of the coin.
So how does traditional pain medication work? Does it target the sodium channel?
No. The traditional pain medications, there are things like the NSAIDs, the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. There are drugs like gabapentin, and there are the opiate drugs, and they do not target the sodium channel. There are drugs that target sodium channels. Tegretol or carbamazepine is one of them, and it's used for epilepsy. It's useful in one form of pain called trigeminal neuralgia, but in most other forms of pain, it's not effective. And the reason for that is that there are 9 different types of sodium channels. When I went to medical school and got my PhD, we learned about the sodium channel as if there was one type. We now know there are 9 different types. These sodium channels play key roles in the brain. The existing sodium channel blockers are non-selective. They block or put to sleep all of the types of sodium channels. And so if you get them to a high dose, you can have loss of balance or double vision or confusion or sleepiness. So it's hard to get them to a dose that would alleviate pain. Now, despite that, almost all of us have had the experience of going to a dentist. We receive an injection, a local injection, of Novocaine or lidocaine, and we don't feel pain. And Novocaine and lidocaine are sodium channel blockers, but what's happening there is they're being locally applied to one particular nerve. If you took those drugs in the form of a pill, you would have these off-target side effects of sleepiness, confusion, double vision. So a holy grail of pain research had been, might there be a type of sodium channel that is present in our peripheral pain signaling nerve cells, the ones that innervate the surface of our bodies? And if so, if it existed, could it be targeted to alleviate pain without these central side effects? And it turns out that NaV1.7 meets all the criteria for being a peripheral sodium channel. So it's become a topic of intense research, both in the academic world and within the biopharmaceutical industry.
So I imagine that industry and those companies are busily trying to come up with a drug that would effectively target NaV1.7.
Many of the biopharmaceutical companies, large pharmaceutical companies, small biotech companies, are actively pursuing NaV1.7 as a target. Some of these companies have large teams working on this.
And are you optimistic they'll come up with something soon?
I personally am optimistic that they will come up with something. We're working with a number of them. I'm not sure I would use the word soon. When you do research going from the laboratory to human beings, things by definition have to occur in a very systematic way. We live in a society that's heavily regulated. Certainly none of us want to do anything that is going to cause any harm in patients. And so things sometimes go slowly. I'm confident that we will end up with a new class of much more effective pain medications that don't affect the brain. And these medications will not have those central side effects, and they will not have addictive potential. But it's going to take some years.
And how are you so confident that there won't be unintended side effects?
Well, the reason is that in our patients with gain-of-function mutations of NaV1.7, we see pain, but we don't see any other abnormalities of the nervous system. And in the patients with loss of function of NaV1.7, we see this remarkable absence of ability to feel pain, but no other abnormalities of nervous system function. So that fits with what we have learned from animal studies and from laboratory studies, saying that this channel is functional and important only in our peripheral pain signaling nerve cells.
But is there a risk possibly of permanently turning it off? In other words, turning a Pam into a Steven?
that is a risk, and that's a very important risk. Pain has a protective value, and so we don't want to totally turn off pain. And one good thing about small molecule blockers is that we can titrate the dose. We want to alleviate pain. We don't want to shut it down totally.
Okay, so you say it might not be soon. When you say that, what's the ballpark?
we began working with patients with the Man on Fire syndrome in 2004. Here it is 2017. That's 13 years. And on the one hand, that seems like an awful long time. If you compare it to other areas of research, however, we've moved very, very rapidly. The gene for Huntington's disease was discovered in the late 1980s, and we still don't know how it causes Huntington's disease. In this case, the gene for the Man on Fire syndrome was found in 2004, and we know in great detail, exhilarating detail, exactly how it causes pain and exactly what its role is. And we're beginning to have blockers being developed by the biopharmaceutical industry. So we're moving, in fact, on a fast track. But my sense is that drugs will not be ready for licensing by the FDA and similar agencies, certainly for another 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Oh, that's really soon. You sounded so doom and gloom a minute ago. I mean, that's right around the corner, really.
In a sense, it's right around the corner. On the other hand, we're very aware that there are people in chronic pain who need something. Mm. They need something now. We speak with a lot of parents of children, and so they want something as fast as it can be safely delivered. My prediction is that after the first set of NAV1.7 blockers receive approval, my prediction is that there will rapidly be more interest within the biopharmaceutical industry, because this is a chronic pain is an immense unmet medical need. And 4 or 5 years after the first drugs were introduced, there'll be second generation drugs in which side effects are engineered out and efficacy is made even better. So that's where the real impact is going to be. We're looking 10, 12 years from now.
But can you envision a future where, and a not too distant future, where we will have eradicated most pain?
It's certainly my goal. My sense is it's an achievable goal. Whether we'll totally eradicate pain, I don't know. But certainly right now we have many individuals throughout our country, throughout the world, suffering from chronic pain that we can't do much to relieve. And my sense is that in the future, pain will be much, much more treatable.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Stephen Waxman. He's professor of neurology at Yale Medical School and director of the Neuroscience Research Center at Veterans Affairs, Connecticut. Coming up on the program, why trendy chefs are serving old-timey grains like einkorn and kamut. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Heritage grains are making a comeback here in California. These are the ancient, unadulterated varieties of crops like wheat, barley, or rice. More farms are growing them now because they have stronger flavors and they are drought tolerant. And many LA restaurants are eager to incorporate them into some of their dishes. Here to tell us more about heritage grains and where to find them is our regular food expert, Catherine Spires, food editor at the LA Weekly. Hi.
Hi.
So before we get into this, when we say heritage grains, what are we talking about?
We're talking pre-industrial revolution, the grains that have been around for a very long time before people figured out that you could process food and make a lot more money off of it.
Oh.
So in terms of our experience with them, these tend to be grains that are bred for flavor, not just for disease resistance, for instance, or ones that will stand up to processing. So people used to put out catalogs of different wheats and talk about them in the same language that they talked about wine.
Really?
Mm-hmm, yeah, you'd want some for your savory breads. You would want to use different ones for your sweet pastries, for instance.
And then that all fell out of favor when there was mass industrialization. People just wanted a bag of white flour.
That's exactly right. Yeah, or at least that's what the companies wanted to sell to people, because it's much easier to just have the one kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then what happened to the grains? Where did they go?
A lot of them almost disappeared entirely. Some people would grow them at home. Some people were growing them at, for instance, universities just for studies. But in recent years, some farmers have realized that these grains that they were using as rotation crops, they could actually plant some interesting varieties and maybe make a profit off of them.
And can you tell the difference when you eat a bread made from one of these grains versus your regular old wheat?
Yeah, it sounds like hippie nonsense, but you absolutely can. It's kind of amazing.
So what is the difference? Can you describe it?
Yeah, some of the, like a Sonora wheat, for instance, that's one that you can find via Rowan Mills, which is a local company. It really does taste buttery without having buttered the bread.
Mm.
It's kind of incredible. And it's a relatively hardy wheat as heritage grains go, so it's good for bread making. And it's even got, you'll find the word nutty used to describe heritage grains a lot. And it's true. You really do get that sort of nutty, almost toasted already flavor from them. It's kind of incredible.
Well, what's the downside? That they just don't keep for long?
They don't keep. And because so few of them are being grown, they're expensive.
Ah. Yes.
Yeah.
There's always that.
Of course.
Okay. So that means it's a specialty food item.
Yes.
And you can get them at specialty food shops.
Uh-huh. Yeah. In terms of getting like the whole wheat or even just the ground flour, you can find them some places. Rowan Mills, again, will sell the flours or the flour that they have ground already. There's a company called Bob's Red Mill that you can order online for. And they're amazing. They're good for people with gluten intolerance, too, because anything that can be ground and used as flour, they've got it. So that's a good resource, too.
You can get that at Gelson's.
Yes.
I've seen it.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if Gelson's carries every variety, but yeah, that's Gelson's is a good place to get it.
Okay. So it does seem to be seeping into the mainstream.
A little bit. Certainly. Yeah. More people are using it. More people are aware of the different flavors the different grains can bring to a dish. So restaurant owners and chefs are having a really fun time right now playing around with these different grains.
Okay. So give us some examples of where we can taste that.
So Lodge Bread Company, that's in the Palms, Culver City area, they will always have a rotating bread that they are calling ancient wheat. Or they also have another one that they call the super special. And both of those tend to be grains that we haven't heard of. They use a grain called called Kamut, K-A-M-U-T. It's similar to spelt, mm-hmm. and it's just a different fun one that they like to play around with. There's a place in Pasadena called Seed Bakery. They use Kamut a lot as well as Einkorn. It's not corn. It's corn spelled with a K.
It's just one corn.
Yeah, just the one corn. Einkorn might be the oldest grain that is still available commercially. So we're talking back to biblical times. So you kind of get a little bit of like a sense of history when you're biting into that loaf of bread made with truly ancient grain.
Wow. And maybe some locusts too.
Yeah, why not? For protein. If you want to go to a restaurant where they've already prepared the dishes for you, there's a restaurant called Baru that's in Hollywood. They make a lot of grain bowls, and one of them is made with a grain called Job's Tears. This one is incredibly rare.
It's Job's Tears?
Job's Tears. Because
what
when
is it?
It looks like barley, but it's not barley. It's its own grain. Before you hull it, it sort of has this like glistening quality to it that almost makes it look like a teardrop. But then when you take the hull off, it looks like barley. So, I mean, there's a whole world of grains we don't even know about.
Where are they getting Job's Tears and these other?
They are importing it from Asia. Rice Bar downtown has a similar project going on where they import their rice from the Philippines. And the reason they do that is because in the Philippines, there is a wide variety of rices available to eat. So if you want to compare rice, you can order your rice bowl with, say, black rice or red rice. And of course, brown rice as well, but mm-hmm. different varieties of brown rice. So there's just, you know, we think we know what grains are because we all eat sandwich bread, but there's just a whole bunch of stuff going on
with
it.
Wow, we blow my mind here. So also all that rice, so much rice.
Right.
So are we growing that here in California?
Rice tends to be grown up in the Bay Area. It hasn't in terms of like artisanal rices. There's less of a market for that. But these, the wheats are making more inroads into California right now. And because it can be grown on the same land that other crops are grown on, that's one of the reasons why more farmers are getting into it.
And farmers in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of Tehachapi. The Tehachapi Grain Project is probably the biggest, most organized, most well-known one right now. So they're growing grains, wheats all over Southern California. And sort of they've kind of are handing them off to chefs saying, you see, does this make good pasta? And then they can practice with it. And it's kind of a collaborative effort.
So if you're an ambitious home cook, where would you buy these grains to cook at home?
You can, again, you can buy them online. You can buy them from at a bunch of farmers markets. These days, there's a lot of farmers who are selling not only the finished product, but like the crop itself. So your good sized farmers markets, you're going to be able to find, if not the whole grain, at least the flour that's made from the grain that they grow themselves.
Isn't there a thing where you have to mill it as soon as you use it, because otherwise it loses its vital properties?
Well, you know, people who are in the wheat world are going to be, they call themselves grainiacs, by the way. The grainiacs are going to be a little more obsessive about those qualities. But there are some home cooks who are really getting into it. But yeah, you're going to have to buy all the equipment if you want to buy the whole wheat berry.
You're going to have to mill it yourself.
Mill it yourself. Bake it immediately, like before the fats start to dissolve. Yeah, I mean, it's a big endeavor, but if you've got many free weekends and need a new hobby, go for it.
Catherine Spires, food editor for the LA Weekly and host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here with a listener feedback. Hi.
Yes, listener feedback. You talked earlier about the Silver Lake Reservoir with Alyssa Walker from Curbed. Uh-huh. And she said that maybe it shouldn't be called Silver Lake Reservoir anymore. Maybe
it's no longer a reservoir.
It's not really a reservoir. Maybe it should be called Silver Lake Lake. Carolina Miranda tweeted and said maybe you should call it Silver Lake Folly. Carrie Jacobs likes Silver Lake Sea.
Like the Salton Sea.
Exactly. Ellis Tucker would love to see a combination of reservation land, public park, and urban farm community gardens, but I guess that's not going to happen. Instead, we're just going to have that concrete lake surrounded by that ugly chain link fence. That's the thing that always bummed me out about it.
The fence.
The fence.
They could bring the fence down.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That'd be nice. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.